Welcome to Psydactic Residency Edition. I am Dr. O'Leary, a fourth-year psychiatry resident in the National Capital Region. This is a podcast about psychiatry and neuroscience. I produce it to help me to understand what I do. Because this podcast is my own venture, I have to warn you that everything I say here is my own opinion, complete with my own biases, misinterpretations, and probably most importantly, missing data. If I wanted to, I could just cherry-pick some facts from studies that I want you to know about and pretend like these represent the whole picture. I don't have any fact-checkers or editorial staff to rein me in. I try to be as complete and fair as I can, but in the end, I get to be the judge of that, so listeners beware. I also do not speak for the federal government or the Department of Defense or Defense Health Agency, any drug company, or the California Dried Plum Board, though diarrhea may or may not be a side effect of listening to this podcast. Today, I'm going to talk about what might be the most famous psychiatric study of this century, the sequenced treatment alternatives to relieve depression study, or STAR-D for short. STAR-D is a must-know study among psychiatrists and often even primary care doctors. It's even included in the book, 50 Studies Every Psychiatrist Should Know. This mashup of an acronym and initialism began in 2001, but the main results in each leg of the study weren't published until about 2006, along with a summary paper of all of the studies together in the American Journal of Psychiatry. STAR-D was an open-label, multi-center trial that analyzed the effectiveness of various antidepressant strategies in adult patients who had presented to one of 41 clinics and who had screened positive for depression. This was kind of designed to be a real-world intention-to-treat type analysis. It was large and very expensive, including over 4,000 adults. The study was designed with a stepwise treatment strategy that started with a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, citalopram is the one they used. And if this did not result in remission, remaining patients move on to other strategies, including other antidepressants or antidepressants that were augmented by other things like bupropion. And this went on for a total of 4 treatment opportunities. It was important to do this because other trials estimating the effectiveness or the efficacy of antidepressants tend to include patients that screen positive for depression alone and don't have other comorbid psychiatric conditions. By removing patients with multiple conditions from like drug trials, especially initial drug trials, the idea is that the effectiveness of the drug for the target illness can be estimated in a kind of a best-case, noise-free scenario. Trials also tend to recruit participants, like actively go out and look for participants, but this one included patients who had presented themselves to a clinic. The real world is frequently messy and uncontrolled, and the STAR-D trial was really meant to figure out if the current antidepressant strategies that were actually in use were effective in the real world. The authors of the STAR-D trials reported in their final kind of summary paper that cumulatively about two-thirds, 67%, of patients had achieved remission after 4 trials of medication. I mean, some had achieved it in the first trial and the second, but throughout 4 trials, cumulatively, two-thirds of the patients achieved remission. In the first step, they reported that 37% of patients remitted. Of the remaining patients, about 30% remitted in the second step. And if you combined the third and fourth step together, about 30% more remitted. Altogether, In this real-world scenario, it appeared that about two-thirds of people would benefit from some kind of pharmacotherapy for depression, if they were actually willing kind of to stay in therapy and try four different strategies for up to a year before achieving remission. Now, that actually sounds very effective on the surface. I mean, it sounds like for every three patients we treat with antidepressants, two of them will get better if they stick with it, whether it's because of the antidepressant or not. I mean, at least that's how the study has been reported. This remission rate's been questioned over the years, and in October 2023, the journal BMJ Open, or the British Medical Journal Open, published an article that reports to have reanalyzed the data from the STAR-D trial using what they say was the original study design. This reanalysis found much, much lower rates of remission. It reported the cumulative remission rate as only 35%. How did two different sets of researchers using the same data set get a result that's like half of what the other researchers reported? That is the mystery that I'm going to report on today. The first author on this reanalysis, Ed Pigot, actually I'm not sure that's how to pronounce his name. It could be Pigot or Pigot or Pigot, but I really prefer to pronounce it like waiting for Godot, so I will say Pigot. Anyway, Dr. Pigot has a PhD in psychology and has published and blogged about this topic before. His previous papers kind of pointed out various ways in which the STAR-D authors appeared to have maybe deviated from their primary research design in a way that inflated the efficacy of the treatments. He has authored other articles that are critical of the way that, in general, the literature on SSRIs has been biased by various factors, including publication bias, different kinds of p-hacking, which could be an episode all on its own, and I probably will do one in the future, or just intentionally obscuring results, like not publishing negative results. These sorts of criticisms are not unique to Pigot. There is a reckoning overall in psychology and all the medical sciences right now regarding this kind of century of biased and at times apparently fraudulent results being published and accepted as dogma. So this has resulted in far more oversight of research, including the FDA and many journals requiring that studies publish their methods before conducting the study, or even hiring outside firms to administer the research, which can help prevent data manipulation, among other things. A journal might, for example, require a study to be pre-registered with them, and the results of it have to be published, whether they're negative or not. There's also a broad, privately funded initiative now that encourages and supports authors getting access to data from trials that were either not published or that reported results that other researchers believe are either not valid or accurate or didn't stick to the original research design. It's called the RIAT Initiative, R-I-A-T, and you can find their website at restoringtrials.org. They report that, well, at least until August of 2022, 100% of their funding came from a philanthropic organization called Arnold Ventures. Today's episode is at least in part about kind of this larger issue, this issue of scientific reporting. The kinds of changes that were made to the protocol of the STAR-D trial can and should be analyzed in the context of research ethics and questionable practices. I also want to mention that before I go any further, I'm not making any accusations of fraud. Pigot, personally stated in 2010 in a blog post on the site Mad in America, I'll quote it here, "This is a story of scientific fraud, with this fraud funded by the National Institute of Mental Health at a cost of $35 million, unquote. He's referring to the published results of the STAR-D trial. Now, I'm very much doubt myself. I very much doubt that the authors were intentionally defrauding anyone. But it is very common for researchers to introduce bias by making decisions or assumptions that they feel are reasonable, but still result in inflating the significance of their work. Ad hominem attacks of fraud do raise red flags, but they do not directly address the questions themselves of, like, what is the appropriateness of the changes that were made to STAR-D's initial protocol and the validity of the reported results given these changes. Bigot et al. Had four main criticisms of the STAR-D summary report. First, they point out that the STAR-D investigators changed their primary outcome measure from the original protocol. Instead of using data from blinded assessors using the Hamilton Depression Rating Scale, aka the HAM-D or the HDSR, the researchers instead converted data from an unblinded clinician-administered scale called the Quick Inventory of Depression Symptoms, or QIDS. I'll call it the QIDS from here on out. They converted that into like HAM-D equivalents so that they could do an analysis with that data instead of data from the HAM-D. So this was an important change for two reasons. The first is that the HAM-D results were gathered by someone who was blinded to the treatment, and I believe they gathered them over the telephone. We know that unblinding can have a dramatic effect on reporting or recording results, so this is pretty concerning. It was reported that the primary reason for this change was kind of this very high dropout rate and high rate of failure of gathering data in a blinded fashion. Data was more reliably gathered in the clinical setting using the QIDS than it was over the telephone using the HAM-D. Also, the primary research protocol had stipulated that failure to report a HAM-D results could count as failure to remit during the analysis, so all that missing data would potentially have biased the results toward a lack of response. The opposite is true, actually, when including unblinded data, which can bias results toward remission, so that's concerning as well. So by making this change, the researchers were likely inflating remission rates. The second criticism that deviated from the initial study protocol was the inclusion of patients who did not even meet criteria for depression on their initial HAM-D results. I mean, there were over 900 patients who had a HAM-D score of 14 or less, and 14 was the initial cutoff. Of these, there were about 100 patients who scored less than 8, which would have qualified them to have remitted even before they started that leg of the study. Including these patients could potentially have made it look as if 100 more patients had remitted even though they started below the remission cutoff. And patients with scores below 14 could be biased toward remission because they already have a subthreshold symptom score to begin with. They are already close to remission. It's also possible that some of these patients got worse and no longer qualified as remitted, but the study was not designed to see how people without depression respond to treatment. And so including everyone under 14 includes patients without depression, at least without the kind of depression that would include them in the study. Changes in who was excluded or not excluded from the analysis did not stop there. The third major criticism of the 2006 analysis was that they did not include all of the dropouts. 370 of the participants dropped out after starting citalopram in the first phase of the study, but were not included in the final analysis the way the protocol had planned. Participants who dropped out were supposed to be counted as non-remitters, but they were not. The final major note of contention was that the study was supposed to only bring forward non-remitters into the next step of treatment, but that did not happen with fidelity. 125 participants were moved forward into the next level of treatment and included in the analysis, despite, at that time, already meeting criteria for remission prior to starting that level. It appears that the results reported by STAR*D authors were the most favorable results possible, given the data, and likely, dramatically inflated the real-world effectiveness of the treatment strategies employed in the study. The results of the reanalysis calculated a cumulative remission rate of only 35%, or 41% if you include the substitution of the QIDS scores for missing HAM-D scores. And this is versus the 67% reported in the original study. Also, with regard to the STAR*D study trying to be realistic, Pigot et al. Pointed out that patients entering to the study were treated for free. They didn't have to pay for it. And they were also treated with like the highest standard of care available at the time. Is this the way care is given in the real world? I mean, looking at the study from Pigot's perspective makes it seem like the original data actually suggests that our treatment strategy for depression in the real world is at best barely effective, and possibly not any more effective than a placebo. I mean, even though this study was not placebo-controlled, response rates around one-third are commonly reported for placebo treatments in mental health conditions. But it would not be fair to, like, mic drop at this point and just walk away. I mean, the authors of the STAR*D deserve their chance to respond. Pigot had published similar criticisms to this in 2010 and 2015, but didn't have access to the data set and had not reanalyzed the entire data set previously. Rush et al., the authors of the STAR*D trial itself, also had not responded to these previous publications. I mean, at least not that I could find. Maybe they did. But I do know that they did respond in October of 2023 by writing a letter to the American Journal of Psychiatry. And this letter was published this month, December 2023. Rush et al.'s responses criticized Pigot et al.'s removal of over 900 patients included in the total analysis in the original STAR*D summary paper. They propose that a truly real-world view of effectiveness of trials requires an inclusive approach. In the papers that preceded the summary of the STAR*D trial, the papers that summarized each step before the whole summary was reported, had garnered kind of harsh criticism because patients in these analyses were coded as non-remitters if they had missing HAM-D scores. And the criticism said this potentially resulted in much too low an estimate of remission. So people without HAM-D scores could have remitted or not. So it's really very conservative to score them all as not remitted. Also, the HAM-D was scored at the beginning and end of each step of treatment, which means that there's kind of no middle ground, no mid-treatment result to track progression. So the use of the QIDS score, the QIDS score, which was administered at every follow-up, and reasonable kind of to use as a proxy in the event that the patient did not return for follow-up. They may not have returned, well, because they felt much better. So finally, Rush et al. Claim that Pigot et al. Mischaracterized their paper entirely. So I'll let their words speak for themselves. I quote, "What Pigot and colleagues fail to appreciate is that the overall outcomes of patients across 1 year of treatment reported by Rush et al. Was not an a priori identified analysis in the protocol, but a secondary post hoc report, specifically requested by the editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Psychiatry at that time, with the goal of summarizing the clinical outcomes of this complicated multi-level trial. As such, the use of different methods and alternate measures in secondary analysis is a well-accepted scientific approach to explore the data and develop new hypotheses for future research. Unquote. Sometimes I find myself agreeing with everything someone says, but still disagreeing with the fundamental conclusions they come to. And I think this is one of those cases. I do feel that Pigot et al. Sensationalized the shortcomings of the STAR*D trial and took a worst-case scenario approach to their reanalysis. However, I also feel like the STAR*D trial has not been read as, quote, a scientific approach to explore the data and develop new hypotheses for future research, unquote. I mean, it's taught as the foundational confirmation of effectiveness of the contemporary approach to pharmacological therapy for depression. The weight of the evidence appears to be that STAR*D is, in fact, not all that it's cracked up to be, and the authors of the paper have not been vocal enough in tempering the huge wave of misinterpretation of their results. It does not appear to be a blatant example of scientific fraud. I mean, it's scientifically flawed, but it's not scientific fraud. Pigot et al. In his 2010 blog may have been suffering kind of from a hefty dose of moral outrage that influenced his choice of words when he called it a fraud. Pigot's own reanalysis appears to just attempt to swing the pendulum as far back as it can go, but in doing this, it appears that both studies, by reporting the extreme results of the data if you massage it in a certain way, are probably both missing the truth. Thank you for listening. I am Dr. O'Leary, and this has been an episode of Psydactic Residency Edition. Thank you.